This is the Authentic Persuasion Show. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 2, segment 2 of my conversation with Barry Erickson from the University of Washington Sales Program. My name is Jason Cutter. This is the Authentic Persuasion Show. Super excited you're here. If you're watching this or listening to this online, make sure to catch part 1. If you didn't, we talked about authenticity and Barry discussed a wide range of things coming from his over 30 years of experience in sales and sales management that included some Fortune 500 companies, and then his transition the last 6 years where he is now part of a sales education program and teaching and development now at UW in Seattle. And so that first part was amazing. Now we're going to talk about persuasion. Barry, in between our recordings here, Barry freshened up his afternoon coffee. He's ready to go. Coffee's for closers. So you deserve it, Barry, for sure. Welcome. I had to throw that in. Welcome to part 2. You ready to go?
Well, segued there, Jason. you've done well with that. I show that clip in class, obviously the famous Alec Baldwin clip, and the students' jaws drop. I mean, in today's generation, we won't describe the adjectives, but Alec Baldwin wouldn't necessarily identify with them, or vice versa today, would we?
And what's fascinating and fun, total side note, and because you brought it up, but I've done a few of those. It's a good reminder to do more of them, which is my own kind of reaction/sales coach videos of clips from movies that people reference, like sales, like Glengarry Glen Ross, Boiler Room, Wolf of Wall Street, things like that, and taking that scene and like talking about like what's terrible, you know, from what salespeople used to do or why people hate sales, to also some like valuable coaching moments. I mean, the ABC can be good advice, always be closing, but the problem with that, and you talked about this in the first part, which is a super unplanned segue into this portion on persuasion, which is it depends on what always be closing means to you. If it's always be closing to get that sale, to get the money right now, no matter what, before you walk out, like when you first started in sales on the rotary phones, where it was, you know, you expected to close in one call or else, that's what's gross and what people don't like about high-pressure sales people or being in a high-pressure role. Let's talk about it because we're just ripping on this. Is to you, especially in this modern world of sales and what you talked about, relationships and long-term and that mode, where do you see the ABCs being applicable or does it fit in still?
It certainly does fit in from a mindset standpoint, because we don't, while we tell students and we tell professionals, regardless of who we're instructing, you're not going to close the deal on the first take. Get it out of your head that you have to close on the first take. However, closing a deal and closing an action item are two different things with the same concept. So ABC, always be closing some action or some reason to get back to the customer. So I use ABC in the sense of, let's find reason to have another meeting. Let's find reason to follow up with the customer so you can get your name back in front of them again. So on that first visit, Jason, while I don't teach my students to close on the first meeting, I expect them to come up with an action item on the first meeting, and that's some reason to get back in front of them again. Cut the meeting 5 minutes short, 10 minutes short, so that you can schedule that second meeting and get an extra 20 minutes. That's the strategy, and the students like that because it takes pressure off of them. And in my experience, most customers, if you don't gobble up all their time and if you are sensitive to their schedule, they'll give you a second meeting, and maybe you can do it over lunch. And what a better way to go. So always be closing an action item. You don't have to close the deal. Got to keep that in mind. Yes.
I absolutely love that. I'm just like so excited you say that. One of the things that I hear a lot, especially, you know, from potential clients or people who might want me to speak for their audience, is they always want to know if I have industry experience for what they're selling. And I come from a mostly not transactional, it's an enrollment, but it's usually more one call enrollment and it's B2C, right? So not B2B. And so what I tell people though is every single interaction is a sale. Every conversation you have with a potential client is a sale. And when you look at that, you have a beginning, a middle, and an end. You have steps you want to go through. You have a relationship you have to build every time. If it's the third or fourth meeting, you're going to do it quicker, right? You don't need as much rapport and you don't need as much empathy and discovery. And you can skip through some of those steps. But every single thing, like you said, which I love, is that is always an action. The close at the end of the first meeting is scheduling the second meeting, right? And having something that you're going to do, or somebody has homework that they have to give to the other person, right? Is there's always a thing. And when salespeople start to realize that and go, like you said, it takes the pressure off of, I have to close this deal now, which might not be the case, especially for most professional enterprise level sale. And then B, realize like, okay, my goal is to sell the next step. Sell the next step and get to the next step. And then I can get to the next step from there. And when you do that, then it makes the process so much easier. And then you're looking at persuasion differently, which is how do I just get to the next step and play the long game, right?
Right. Very much so. I spoke in the last segment about my first day of class in breaking down paradigms and stereotypes of salespeople. And when I ask students, what do you know about sales? And they go through a bunch of stereotypes. One of them will always say, hey, I've heard like in a car lot, if the customer walks off the lot without selling, you have less than a 3% chance of selling them a car. If that's what sales is, that's a lot of pressure. That's the kind of thing that I battle early on to teach them, hey, B2B sales isn't that way. You know, if you don't close in the first meeting, that doesn't mean you have a less than a 3% chance of closing. It's probably the other way around. If you give up after that first meeting, yes, of course, they're not going to come back and buy. But to your point, Jason, yes, persuasion is a process. It's not necessarily a skill at the table right then and there. I see it.
With you, when you look back through your amazing sales and sales leadership career, in again where you started rotary phone book mode to internet and then selling, and then, you know, before you get into the teaching, you know, season of your life, is there any sales processes you preferred? Is there anything that you found worked well? Is there anything, you know, or a combination like that you just know is a good foundational strategy that you like?
The one thing that I learned early on when I closed my very first deal with Southwest Airlines, I was selling in the airline industry early on. Very first deal with Southwest Airlines, I found the value, or I discovered the value of good customer references early on. I established a great relationship with another company. I won't mention that, who they are, but the other company flew the same airplanes as Southwest, 737s, and we were doing a deal to try to get Southwest in. And referencing another customer who flew 737s to Southwest Airlines, they picked up the phone and called them, was a godsend for us. Everything that I had just been stating and promising and selling to the customer was proven by the other customer. So ever since, Jason, throughout all the technology change processes over the years, still today, I teach my students, establish a great relationship with a great customer who will vouch for you. And that will put you miles ahead. And what I also find is if you give a reference to a customer, they won't call them necessarily either. They just are so impressed that you have the guts to give a name and a contact that they trust that.
Well, and that plus what you said in the first segment when we were talking about authenticity, and you know the kind of stuff that you're teaching your students to do when they go into sales, a lot of it comes down to the one piece I tell people, which is when in doubt, just do the opposite of what you think a salesperson would do. And in generally, salesperson's not going to give a reference to another company because they're worried about what that other customer is going to say and if they're going to be happy or not. Probably because they either forgot out some of the details like we've discussed or pushed too hard or did something on a transactional, not a relationship mode, and sold for the deal and not, you know, for the long term. Did the students think when you talk about those stories?
Yeah, and also not to interrupt you, but also you said something that also triggers a paradigm, I think, that many of us salespeople have is we think our customers are not willing to engage with their competitors. In other words, customer A, mine, customer B, mine, customer C, mine. They're all in the same business back in the day, airline industry. No, they're actually friends. Those airlines want to learn from their colleagues on who to use. And I learned early on that you can trust referencing a competitor to your customer, not your competitor, but their competitor. From a reference standpoint. And I learned that a lot of these people knew each other to begin with. Because when I gave the Southwest Airlines reference from the other customer, the fellow said, oh, I know her. I haven't talked to her in a long time. I'm going to give her a call. What a powerful moment for me, right? I call it the conviction point. The conviction point is when you know you got that customer. I knew at that moment. When he said, oh, I know her. I haven't talked to her in a long time. I'm going to give her a call. That was the conviction moment for me. Very powerful as a salesperson.
And I think there's a level of believing and trusting in abundance and in people that from a sales perspective, when you do that, A, you don't have to force every deal and every conversation, like you've been saying. And then also you're willing to share that kind of thing or even ask if someone can do a reference, be a reference for you as a customer, because you understand there's more than enough and that you trust, hey, if it's the right customer and you know they're open-minded, they'll be happy to share as well. And I know I have those same experiences with other salespeople I know, and they're like, no, I can't tell anybody about any of my customers, and I would never ask for that because no one's ever going to share. And that's a reflection of their beliefs, not their customers' beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, every company's a little different. Every philosophy's a little different, but our company was very transparent, very open. Mm. And of course, my boss says, you have to get the customer's permission. But Jason, I can't think of once when I was rejected for that ask. So we did it.
Interesting. So again, the theme of a lot of the stuff that you've been talking about, whether it's, you know, in the first part or even this in the process specific, is the relationship building and just focusing on that, right? The bigger picture than in the moment, the one call, the one deal, the one meeting. One of the things you referenced at the end of the last episode was loving to make cold calls, enjoying that process, you know, and the sales process. And again, sales is fraught with disappointment and rejection. That's just the nature of the game. If it wasn't, then everyone would do it and then probably wouldn't get paid anything for it. And so where does that fit in with you, with that process where you learned that, you know, and how do you approach, how would you approach those calls, even if you were to do them today? Or what do you do with the students to teach them that, you know, the sales process side?
Yeah, I will admit this. I've had the luxury of great brands. I've represented great brands. And not to suggest that I wouldn't have the confidence and the success if I didn't have great brands. But when you get to call somebody and you're proud of who you are and you get questions about your company or about your product and you can build rapport early on, because they've heard of you or because you're just in an interest with an interesting product, takes all the bite away and takes the drag away for making that call, for obviously the obvious reasons. Number one, they are going to take your call. They recognize your brand. And number two, they are interested in your company to be able to ask about certain things going on. For example, right now, I still call from the University of Washington to get sponsors of the business school. The dean wants me to make phone calls, right? For sponsorship, internships, dollar raising. And when you get to represent the Foster School of Business or the University of Washington, it's not like a cold call at all. It's like an information session. And they start asking questions, and I'm just proud of who I represent. That takes some of the sting out of it. That's one piece. Number two, I have a very, very structured and diligent approach to when I make the first call and I don't get the call back, my second call and I don't get the call back, the third, maybe an email. I have a great process that is, I'll call it passively aggressive. It's not aggressive. It's not abrasive, but I use a very diplomatic approach to be diligent, to follow up with the customer so that they know I'm not going away, Jason. It's a very fine line when you show somebody I am that thing that will not leave, but I'm going to be doing it in a very diplomatic, non-abrasive, friendly way. I almost look at it, Jason, I don't get rejected for a cold call, but it may take me four or five calls to make. Some students will go, oh God, I don't have the patience for that. Well, if you don't have the patience for that, you probably better think twice about a sales career then.
Yeah. Obviously there's the confidence side, a big brand helps, or your own confidence. Mm-hmm. Even if, you know, and this is the big thing for anyone listening in sales or wanting to get in sales is, without a big brand, if you have a solution that you know truly helps, even if that person doesn't know the solution exists, and there's going to be an education piece to it, when you know that you have something that will help the right people in the right way and really leave them better than you found them, then that will supplement or be, you know, a good way to go without the brands. I also love what you're talking about, the process. When you have a process like that, when you're putting that in, you know you're going to make your follow-ups, you know what that's going to be. Again, going back to what you said before, it takes the pressure off of needing to close the sale. Right now, you're just closing an action item or getting to the next point where you can try to get the next action item.
Your point's well taken. And Jason, I will say this too. Many of your listeners are probably saying, oh yeah, well, big deal. You got a big brand. People are going to take your calls. Well, big deal. Those that don't take your calls, or if, like you said, if you don't have that big brand, I have learned, because I have sold some non-branded products as well, non-big branded products as well. That's where the personal references come in. That's where when you play the LinkedIn roulette, and you can make that connection through other means, not by your product, but by people or by customers. I've had some customers, believe it or not, cold call on my behalf. In other words, customer A actually cold calls customer B for me. That's pretty higher level relationship. And that might be unique to some folks, but I have had the luxury of being able to rely on that. So it helps.
That's amazing. And I think the last few parts that you just covered is really a key thing for anyone watching or listening. If you're in sales leadership, is that there's A, no one approach, and B, no single resource for how to be successful in sales, right? Mm-hmm. It depends on you, your personality, your product, your service, your brand, and then it's all going to mix together into what is your process, right? What does that look like when you're wanting to persuade the right people forward? There's no one tip, right? There's no one thing people say, oh, what's the best sales book I should read to get, like, yeah. It depends, right? It literally all depends.
Right.
For you, when we talk about, I use the word persuasion a lot, obviously that's the name of the show, but where is that balance for you? Where have you found that in the past between persuasion and manipulation? And then obviously corresponding that to what you're teaching the future of sales.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Great question. And because I know some listeners here today are thinking, hey, this nice guy, authenticity, soft sell persuasion, that sounds good, but you've got to get abrasive if you want to sell. The difference for me has been, at least I do choose the customers I want to work with. And Jason, if I have to get abrasive, I would rather take a step back and just not close that deal and choose a different customer to go after, because there's always going to be another customer. I like to emphasize that with my students so that they know that they don't have to get manipulative, and they don't have to get abrasive, and there doesn't have to be adversarial relationships to get the deal done, that they can choose another customer or choose a different approach. I had a customer at an airline who will remain unnamed that there were this person was just not going to work with me. It was something out of my control, something they knew a mutual friend of mine and didn't like him and held it against me, and it wasn't going to happen. So we just chose to go a different route with a different department to make our sale that way. So my point is, I choose not to beat my head against the wall with certain customers, and I just choose to go a different route. you can call that, hey, Barry, not everybody has the luxury to bail out like that. I wouldn't deem it a bailout. I just think, one, life is too short, and two, there are other customers out there.
Yeah, I think the key with that, and I think we spoke about it in the first segment, is the abundance, right? When versus scarcity. When you feel like customers are scarce, deals are scarce, you're going to cross over the line into manipulation to get what you think you need to get now, versus just playing the long game, or just, you know, playing the odds of, you know, 8 billion people on the planet. So how many do you really need to sell all the time? Where do the students see that? Where do they take that? I'm going to guess they love that perspective, because again, what they're worried that sales requires to be successful.
True, but I will also say it's not that easy either. I can't just teach at some point you realize this is not a customer you want to cut a deal with. A student, I shouldn't speak for all of them, but many students would use that as a quick bailout, Jason. They'd use that as a quick exit door. And so I'm very clear to say this is a very rare exception. You need to have grit. We actually try to talk and teach grit. It's hard to teach grit, but I bring in a lot of speakers. Angela Duckworth is my favorite on passion and perseverance, a little plug for her book. She didn't pay me to say that, but she has an amazing way to help develop and teach grit. Will Smith, the actor, has some amazing clips on what grit is for him and how he gets there. Michael Jordan has amazing clips on grit. So I try to teach the grit, which is getting past and functioning amidst adversity, and push that as hard as we can. So my point to you is this. While on one hand I say, hey, there's certain customers you're just going to, you know, take a step back from, don't let that be the habit, and don't let that be the norm. Make sure that you've got grit, and the grit will get you there most of the time. It is a hard skill to teach. Some people think you either got it or you don't. I think that's true, but I think there's, you know, 25% of us have grit to begin with. 25% of us will never have grit, but that 50% in the middle, you can pull it out of.
Yeah. And I love what you just said. I want to reiterate it, is that balance between this is not the right client or the right time, right? And we just need to wait on this. It's a no go away. It's not a good fit. I shouldn't sell you. I don't like you. Or now's not the right time, versus not just becoming an order taker who is failing out of sales because you're just waiting for the easy deals that feel right. Right. Like there's a very difficult balance that takes some intentionality of finding the middle, right? Where you're not an order taker and you're not manipulating, but you're doing the right thing for the right people at the right time and moving them forward. And I think that's really the key, and going to that, you know, again, the manipulation and persuasion is, where is that balance, and when, how do you stay on the persuading, you know, positive intent side versus crossing over? Last question of this one here, as I knew this was going to happen. So our conversations are going long, which I absolutely love. What do you think keeps people from buying from salespeople these days?
Fear of change. It's a hassle. I have my sort, what we call it, the source objection. I'm already buying from this person. And it all depends. Are they fear of change, or is it fear of, you know, maybe they are fear of hurting somebody's feelings by making a change. Maybe they are fear of having to re-update the system with the new supplier. Maybe it's the fear of having to work out shipping differently or different paying terms. It's just a little bit inconvenient. I think that's the reason. There is a great book by another guy named Martin Lewis, and his book is called Why Customers Buy. And he's got some good things to say about that as well. But my personal feeling is it's kind of a hassle. It's an inconvenience, and they don't like change. Some of it legitimate fear. Some of it just, I don't want to be bothered with having to make a change.
Yeah. Makes sense. Some level of change, some fear of change. And on some, you know, sliding scale relative to what they're dealing with. Absolutely love that. Think that's a great place to leave this on the persuasion piece, because, you know, in sales, you've got to understand what the other person is dealing with, what they're facing, what they want to avoid, whether it's pain or change, whatever that looks like. For people, Barry, who want to reach out to you, chat with you about your program, about what you're doing, or being a part of your program, I know that they can find you on LinkedIn, Barry Erickson. Also, and the links will be in the show notes. I won't read it off here, but if they Google the Foster School of Business at University of Washington and look for the sales program, they can find it there. Barry, again, thank you for being here and sharing all this. It's been a blast on the second segment of Persuasion. I can't wait for the third part.
Very good. Thanks, Jason.
All right. I will let you get to your coffee here as we end this. Hopefully it's still warm. For everyone tuning in, thank you for being a part of this. Again, the goal is to help fill the world with over a million authentic persuaders that would change the way sales is done. It's the same thing that Barry's literally helping teach and influence the future of sales, and changing sales from a dirty word that people just assume is, you know, fraught with ill intent and manipulating and pushing people to buy, versus what it really could mean and what it does mean when it's done by a professional who actually cares about leaving people better off than they found them. And so I appreciate everybody for being a part of this journey, tuning in. Hopefully you got something from this. If you're here, it means that something led you to this episode, which means there was something for you to get and then take back into your sales or sales leadership role. And make sure to tune in for the third part. We're going to talk about the future of sales with Mr. Barry Erickson. And until then, thank you for helping fill the world with authentic persuaders.